Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus. We're going to read Proverbs chapter 1 and try to learn some wisdom. Solomon is writing some pretty heavy-duty, clear wisdom from God for each of us. And it is practical, though it sounds religious. It is useful, though it might at times sound pedantic. It is right, though at times it seems capricious. God wants us to know how to not go and how to go, where to go and where not to go. And he gives us advisements, almost like road signs, I suppose. That might be the best way to describe it. You're driving down a new avenue. You went today. You dropped me off at a place, and you were trying to get to a second place, and you probably didn't know exactly where you were. You probably went back to a particular location from where you knew you could go to your second place. And I imagine most of us go back to the familiar, and boy, have you been lost? Have you been looking? You've been circling? Have you been out like northwest in Balcombe Hills or deep in Vaucluse, and you get on a circle road that just seems to keep winding around? I've been here. I've been on this road before, and I can't get to my right turn. Where is this place? It's just a constant disorienting when you can't find the route to go. Here is a road map from God through Solomon to us. And it all starts with the initializing of the map, of the GPS, if you will, in verse number 7. It says, Yirat Adonai Reshit Da'at. You want Da'at, you want knowledge. It's all going to start with the Yirat Adonai. The beginning of knowledge is the fear of God. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Wow. I'm going to tell you, says Solomon, that here's the beginning of it all. You really want to get started on your map, on the route to heaven. You want to get started on the route to God. You want to get started on the route to wisdom and helpfulness and usefulness in society. It starts with the fear of God. No other word for it. It's fear. It's not awesome reverence. It's not humble diminishing. It is the word for fear. You can't hide it. It's stark. And fear in God. That's the beginning of knowledge. You want to start? This is it. You don't want to start? What does he call you? Fool. Boy, it is so binary. When Solomon speaks, he doesn't pussyfoot around. He tells it like it is. You want to follow God? You want knowledge? You want wisdom? Good on you. Here's how you get it. You fear God. You don't want to fear God? You're an idiot. That's it. Fools despise wisdom. You say, well, I'm not a fool. I don't despise wisdom. I'm not sure about God, or I'm not sure that God is the one I want to think about, or I'm not sure that your view of God is the right God. Maybe Richard Dawkins is right. Maybe the empty tomb, James Cameron, is right. Maybe Da Vinci Code is right. Maybe your God is not the God. Solomon does not backpedal and say, oh yeah, your God and the Hindu gods and the Buddhist God, or no God, are all the same. And we're all basically the same. He says, there's one God, and you better fear him. And if you don't fear him, you're a fool. That doesn't sound multicultural, doesn't it? Does it? It doesn't sound 21st century. And aren't you glad he lived in the 10th century BCE, and he was happy to be there. And he spoke enough good words that 3 millennia later, we're still reading it.
It doesn't sound very politically correct, but why wouldn't it be multicultural?
It's not multicultural in the sense of let everybody have their own religion and honor other people's religion. So much so that when you go in and blast Afghanistan and then Iraq and Muslim this and Muslim that, you say, but basically Islam is a religion of peace. As the president of the U.S. did, that's multiculturalism gone insane.
I was thinking, but this God is for all cultures, so that's why I was wondering.
So I'm basically using it in the term that it's been appropriated, basically co-opted by the press and by tolerance-loving pluralists. who do not see anything unique about the person of Yeshua.
Right.
Look, I don't mind if somebody has a different theology. I don't care if they're excited about their theology, whether a Buddhist or a Sikh or a Muslim or anybody, Catholic, Protestant, I don't care. As long as they don't shoot me because I don't have their view. Be excited, be enthusiastic, love your religion, whatever it is. Just don't go take that sword out and slice anybody's head off. You don't have permission to do that in a multicultural world. Solomon, however, has no sword. I mean, he's not pulling out a sword, he's just pulling out the truth. So then, I mean, with that great overture of the purpose of the book given in verses 2 through 6, the great declaration in verse 7 that almost sounds as stark as an overture by Rossini, then he comes back to the theme in verse 8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction. Don't forsake your mother's teaching. Dad's taught you, mom's taught you. This isn't my thing. This is not news to you. You've been hearing it since you were a puppy. And I would say that the Shema that introduces verse 8, listen or hear, my son, the teaching of your father and your mother, is intended to remind. It's not intended to start an instruction, but to remind. And that's one of Solomon's great strengths, is that he appeals to things that people have been learning for a long time, so that this is now affirmation rather than new instruction. And he says that they're going to be a graceful wreath to your head, ornaments about your neck. You're going to be dressed in good stuff from your head, your neck, and probably we'll get through the rest of the body parts in by chapter 6. There is an ornamentation to your body that is better than Calvin Klein jeans. It's better than the latest Billabong t-shirt. It is the beauty of God. It's the honor of God. It's this grace around your neck and around your head. It's not a war ornament. It's not an armor headgear. It sounds rather pastoral, doesn't it? Graceful wreath to your head. I think the Greeks did this in the Olympics, didn't they? They wore the stephanos, the crown, as a reward for conquering. When you won the Olympic race or the city to serve of its day, you got a graceful wreath around your neck and some kind of ornamental wreath on top of your head. Beautiful. It's a crown, but not a glittery golden one. More floral. That's what God says, that the instructions of your family are going to help you and grace your head. I like that. I need head protection. I need grace around my head. Mark was talking about grace last week, weren't you? With good information. And I like positing myself as a grace-loving person. And when my daughter comes home and says, "Oh, Dad, I broke this that you've treasured for 30 years," and I can be gracious and say, "Look, it's just a thing. Things don't matter. You matter a lot more to me." Those are moments that I treasure, and hopefully she will in due course. And I believe that grace around our head and around our neck, which he will allude to several times in the book, is something that Solomon was holding on to for dear life. A graceful wreath to your head. The Hebrew word is chen for grace, and it is a construct of two Hebrew nouns. So it's really a grace wreath. They use it as an adjective to say graceful, but it's really a grace wreath. And it could be a wreath of grace, or it could be a grace of wreath. You get the idea. There's no adjective when the two nouns are there. And I want that around my head. I want to be a grace-loving person.
And he's saying this comes from wisdom?
He's saying it comes from the fear of God. That everything comes from fearing God. Let me give you a definition of the fear of God. Maybe that'll help. The fear of God is knowing God is with you at all times. Just think on that for a moment. So when you're doing really well, God is with you, and you fear him, and you love him, and he's loving you and embracing you, and you feel right. And when you're doing really badly, and you're yelling at your kid, or you're, the guy blocked you in behind your car. Oh, we had out back yesterday. We had some guy really yelling at an NRMA tow truck. Man, the fella in back was really upset and letting him have it with both barrels. And I thought, good grief, the guy's getting a car out of here. He's going to be gone in 5 minutes. Get over it. So when this fellow's acting out. You know, fear of God for him is going to be realizing God is with him at all times, even right now. And what's he going to feel? Oops. Beat his breast. Cry out, "Oh Lord, forgive me." Fear of God means God is with you at all times. And it is advisory, and it's a check when you're going wrong, and it is an affirmation when you're doing okay. You know, in your role as a parent, you're not trying to catch your kids at all times. You're trying to love them and be with them and encourage them. And yet when they're mucking up, you want them to have a fear of you. Not the fear of the belt that my father always had hanging behind his closet door. Now he's going to give an example of one of the ways that his teaching and the father's instruction will assist this person in what's called, in verse 10 and following, peer pressure. "My son, if sinners entice you," don't you think? They say, "Come with us." You can hear this luring from peers. It might be almost mafiesque. It might be commandeering. But I sense it more as peer pressure. "Come on, let's do this." Verse 14, "Throw your lot in with us. We'll all have one purse. Come on, we'll all..." It sounds like a group of Tom Sawyer friends who are just trying to do some kind of mischief. But it goes beyond mischief, doesn't it? Look at verse 11. "Let's lie in wait for blood." This is not just a practical joke. This is murder on an ambush on a back highway. Let's put a sign up that says detour, and when people take that detour, let's lie in wait for the chariot or the walker of the person who's coming by. So Solomon calls them sinners who entice you. And your first response to a sinner who entices you is, do not consent. Just straight up. Don't consent. "Yeah, but you don't understand, Solomon. These are my buddies. You don't understand, Solomon. These are the people I really want to be friends with. These are the people from whom I expect some kind of affirmation. I don't want to be the outcast in my neighborhood or in my community. I don't want to be the outcast at school or at uni. I don't want to be the outcast in my dance class or at work. I want to be liked." He says, well, if you've decided that they're sinners and that they're asking you to do sinful things, do not consent. See what is required before you consent or don't consent? Is an evaluation by you. You have to make a determination. What are they doing? And is what they're doing sinful? Usually you have to keep listening. And so the conversation goes on. If they say, verse 11, "Come with us. Let's lie in wait for blood. Let's ambush the innocent without cause. The kani chinam. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole as those who go down to the pit. We'll all find precious wealth. We'll fill our houses with spoil. Lots of money. We'll take their wallet. You know, this is going to be great. And throw your lot in with us. You know, look, I just need you to drive. Or I just need you to throw $5 out because we need to buy the special ambushing gear. Now, we're reading this, and you're thinking, what son is going to go off with these boys? You know, why would anybody do that? Haven't you seen a movie where people do this? Haven't you read stories of people doing this? What is it that draws or entices that person to throw his lot in? What draws that person? Throw your lot in with us. There's an us, and we welcome you into the usness. We'll all have one purse. We'll split this 50-50. We'll split this 30-30-30. We'll split, or 33. We'll split this 25-4 times. Come on, this will be really cool. And you get a gang mentality almost. You get a mob mentality, depending on how many there are with you, how many are in this club. But having a sense of belonging and a sense of being one of us is a huge draw in modern days, especially. Now, this in the world where everybody wants to be anonymous, this in the time when everybody wants to be private, and privacy laws and privacy fences and firewalls are growing. But don't you sense there's still a desire within humanity to belong? Maybe more so now. Talk about online communities. Do you belong to any? Facebook, MySpace, groups of electronic groups all over the place. YahooGroups.com.au. I mean, there's all kinds of groups. And people can join them anonymously, or they can join them, "My name is, you know, Bill Clinton." Yeah, I mean, you could be anybody. I think there's a longing within humans in these socially separating days to belong. And I spent some time just the other day with a pastor whose wife died. They were in their 50s, not old at all, but she had cancer and she passed away. And he told me, without blinking, how lonely he was. They'd been married for 25, 30 years. And he misses her. It's been 2 years. I understand that. But he told me from the depths of reality that he was lonely. And I sensed it, and I prayed for him, and I hugged him, and I wish I could see him more often. I told him there were, I'm sure, brothers around, and recommended a couple. He knows plenty of people. He doesn't have a lack of people. But loneliness is not about being in a crowd or not in a crowd. It's belonging, isn't it? You can go hang out at Martin Place every day. That doesn't mean you'll have friends. You can sit at a lunch table. In Singapore, you go to these hawker centers. They're like food courts. They abound, and you can go 24/7, which would be, you know, fattening. But you can go there. It's cheap as. I mean, you can get a great meal for $3-4, and you sit very close to one another. And there are like tables for two adjoining all the way along. So you sit at one, and kitty corner at another one is another fella, and kitty corner from him is you, and just angling across. Then you get some twos and some threes, but there's a whole table of lonely individuals who sit together, and it looks like they're belonging, but they're not talking to each other. So of course I talk to everybody, but but maybe that's my way of belonging, and maybe their physicalness is belonging, but I think it goes beyond that. The reason a man is enticed to do even such wickedness as lying in wait for blood and killing somebody in an ambush and stealing their money is not the money. Throw your lot in with us. We'll all have one purse. It's not the draw of the money. It's the draw of the belonging, I think. What's Solomon's advice? What does he say? Just say no. That's right. Do not consent. Where does consent begin? Where in your being does it begin? I hear it when you say it, but that's when it ends. Where does it begin? It's a choice. It's a mental and willful choice. You see the word choice a couple other times, and most clearly at the end of the chapter when verse 29 says, these are the people God won't listen to. They'll seek me diligently, but they won't find me because, verse 29, they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. Let's go on. Verse 15, my son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your feet from their path, for their feet run to evil. They hasten to shed blood, and it is useless to spread the net in the end. Ambush their own lives. So now he's going to teach a little more about them. But earlier he said to the son, don't consent. Now he says in verse 15, don't walk in the way with them. Why does he say that? He said, don't consent. And now he says, don't walk in the way with them. Because it's possible that the son consented. So he says, now, don't walk in the way. Stop sinning somewhere along the route. You say, look, I know I shouldn't go see that movie. I know it's going to be violent, and I'm going to come out wanting to shoot up Sydney. Go beat up the Melbourne Storm, you know. I shouldn't go talk to that woman. I might end up going off with her somewhere. And I know that wouldn't be healthy for me and my wife and the family. But you still go over and talk to her. Or I know I shouldn't eat that amount of food. I shouldn't order that amount of food. Gluttony is one of the seven deadlies. I know I should. But I ordered it. So now Solomon says, okay, you've gone and talked to that woman. Now turn around and walk away from her. You've ordered that food. Have a bite and walk away. Pay for it. You've got to pay for it. And then leave. Get out of sin somewhere along the route. Watchman Nee says there are three levels of sin. Thinking about it, talking about it, and doing it. And he says similarly, stop somewhere along the route. I like that. I don't know, do you see the picture of the monkeys with the hear no evil, see no evil, and speak no evil? Somehow I think that we ought to prevent our own sinning by some force of volition. And if you can't do it, get a brother or a sister around you to stop you. They talk about a lot nowadays in the post-1990 mentoring wave of accountability groups and the need for such things in the privatized lives of the late 20th, early 21st century. We need people around who say, so You know, you had trouble with that gluttony thing. And I know you went to Sizzler and you took 13 plates full of corn. Are you down to 12? And basically you call people to account. That's what an accountability partner does. And you could have two or three. And they say, yeah, you know, I did really well. I was down to 11 last week. This is good. And you commend somebody who's going towards godliness and away from the seven deadly sins, or away from whatever that one sin is that seems to be crippling them. Accountability is dangerous, but it could be right. Dangerous because now people know what's going on.
What does number 17 mean?
Verse 17 says, indeed, it is useless to spread the net in the eyes of any bird. In front of a person you're trying to ambush, don't spread the net. You have to spread it out the night before. And then you put the leaves on it, and then they step into it, or the bird catches it, and they snare the fowler. An ambusher counts on simplicity by the bird or the walker in the wilderness or whoever it is. And the clever people are those who lay the trap. But the father, Solomon, is advising the son, don't go with those people. Keep your feet from their path. They're running to evil. They're in a hurry to do this wrong. Don't do it in front of people. I mean, this is probably the advice. It's useless to spread the net in the eyes of any bird. It's probably, this is their saying, the ambushers saying. And you would, when you set an ambush, describe the speech that you make to one another. Where are you doing it? Say you're doing it off the side somewhere, on that side road, down a laneway or something. Describe for me your speech. Is it loud? Is it soft? Is it punctuated with? Describe how it sounds.
It would be fairly soft.
A whisper. I see this in real... Don't make so much noise. He might be on his way now. You get hushed whispers. Dog whispers, horse whispers, whatever it is. So they lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives. But look in contrast, verse 20, wisdom shouts in the street. She lifts her voice at the square. And she's crying out, how long, O naive ones, will you love simplicity? If you're doing right, you don't have to be secret. You can be as forthright as I was with that rabbi. If you're doing right, you can live your life in the light. Paul wrote to the Ephesians and commented that we should walk in love and walk in the light as Messiah loved us and gave himself as a sacrifice for us, a perfect and sacrificial aroma that's pleasing to God. He did things in the daytime, and sin happens at nighttime. I'm not saying all sin. There's plenty of white-collar sin that happens in the day, but honestly, most sin of the seven deadlies happen in private, in secret, in dark corners, in ambushes. And I guess Solomon is calling us to forthright openness about our lives. And if you understand the fear of God, that he's with you, it doesn't matter if you turn off the lights or not. We'll see the word secret throughout Proverbs. Now look at chapter 4, just a few verses here. A similar warning about the years of your life being many. From verse 14, don't enter the path of the wicked, don't proceed in the way of evil men, avoid it, don't pass by it, turn away from it, pass on. These are like those signs on the off-ramp on the Gore Hill Freeway. You're going the wrong way. You're going back. What are you doing? Turn around. I've told you 83 times. Never mind. Go ahead. Yeah, you see those signs. That's what verse 15 sounds like. For they can't sleep unless they do evil. They're robbed of sleep unless they can make someone stumble. When is that? That's nighttime. They eat the bread of wickedness, drink the wine of violence. But the path of the righteous is like the light of dawn that shines brighter and brighter till the full day. Daytime is when things happen that are righteous. Nighttime is when things happen that can be downright carnal. You see that in Paul's writing to the Romans chapter 13, where he says, similarly, some pairs of sins, carousing and drunkenness, and then greediness, and then some hostility that just keeps going. I see that as things in the dark, and he says that as well. It doesn't mean you have to worry about having shift work, working the graveyard shift at 7-Eleven or a city convenience store. It doesn't mean that. But honestly, there are less people around, there are less lights, and more possibility of doing wrong. Just is that way. Fear of the Lord often includes fear of people. It can include the fear of getting caught Why don't people do some wrong things? Because they don't want to go to jail. They don't want to go to hell. They don't want to go to their mother. They don't want to go to the school principal. There's a fear of punishment. Well, don't do wrong. You won't be punished. All right, back to chapter 1. Look what happens with people in verse 19. The end result of that sin, or ambushing, or darkness, is it takes away the life of its possessors. Yikach, it just takes it away. Wow. Everything that that enticed person thought about violence and ambush and brotherhood is gone. The life of its possessors is taken away. This leaves death. I mean, there's no other option. You have no... You counted on the mob and the boys. You counted on... I mean, why do people join the Ku Klux Klan, for goodness sakes? You think it's hate because they mouth hate. They mouth violence. They spew violence. But it's belonging. They want to belong. It's so individual. It's like a Mason club. It's a... You can hate alone. You don't need people to hate. But they join for the sense of belonging, even though it's a community of hatred. Verse 23 and following. Now, here's God's advice. The wisdom that's shouting in the street, she, I love it, it's a woman, because wisdom is a female word in Hebrew, chokhmah, lifts her voice in the square at the entrance of the gates. She utters her saying. In other words, she's not saying, hey, you got to find me on page 37 in the Sydney Morning Herald. I'm going to be right there and available. I'm going to confront wickedness right in the daytime. I'm going to do it right at the intersection of Bondi Junction and right in your face. This is where grace and faith meet the corner of... this is in your face. It's a very confrontational moment for wisdom, isn't it? She doesn't go to the corner, in the basement and slip out a flyer and put it inside an envelope with 37 other flyers. She's shouting at the intersection. Don't miss it. How long, oh naive ones, will you love simplicity? And how long will you scoff at my instruction? That is downright confrontational. That is tough to do. Could you do it? Could you get out there and shout?
Probably not.
Could you not shout but simply raise your voice? When people intimidate you and lure you, can you say, I don't think so? I remember this scene. It was in a New York City subway. It was very crowded. And I remember this woman who held up her hand high in the midst of the car and said, whose hand is this? And the fellow was right there, and he said, she said, keep it to yourself. And I thought, that's gutsy. This is chutzpah. And that's what wisdom is doing here. She's taking them on. And my, oh my, this woman, wisdom, shouting in the street, lifts her voice in the square. Now, you might think she's kooky. At the head of the noisy street, she cries out. But she is taking on the wisdom of the world and calling it folly. How long will you scoff and love scoffing, and fools hate knowledge? I read a philosopher not long ago who said that he thought hell would be filled with people who still were angry at God and didn't want to go to heaven, but were still upset about injustices that they'd experienced and thought that they were right. It's almost like an eternal jail sentence, because jail, everybody's right. There are no sinners in jail. Everybody there was defrauded, set up, it was scam. No, they're innocent. Everybody in jail is innocent. You ever talk to jail people? You ever gone into prison? Right. Kairos ministry or anything like that? It's fascinating. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they caught me. It was a setup. I shouldn't have been caught. I should only have been here for a year, and I've been here for six. You know, whatever it is, they're injustice. And this philosopher was describing hell as an eternal... such like that. Here's the bottom line. They'll call on me, verse 28, but I'm not going to answer. They'll seek me diligently, but they won't find me. Why? Why? Back up in verse 23. The words of wisdom saying, turn to my reproof. I will pour out my spirit on you. I'll make my words known to you. Here's the three levels of God's call to all of humanity. I'm calling. Don't refuse. See? I'm calling. I'm stretching out my hand. Pay attention. Don't knock back these words from God. Turn to my reproof. It's just a simple, verse 23, teshuva. It's just a simple repentance. The Hebrew word shuv, to turn around. It is God's love which beckons us. And as long as we're turned away from God and facing our peers and doing the things that are ambushing and violent and belonging, we've got our back to the Almighty. He says, turn to me. Turn back. And it comes with reproof, doesn't it? What are you thinking? What are you doing out there? Come back to my teaching. Come back to my love. Come back to my grace. Get that ornament of grace around your head. So number one, turn to my reproof. Admit that you were wrong. Turn around. Number two, I will pour out my Spirit on you. This is God's grace of His love and His Holy Spirit that He promises to pour out on all humanity who will turn to His reproof. This is not something He takes lightly. He's giving you Himself, isn't He? I'll pour out my Spirit. This is personally investing. This is God giving God to you. And then third, what's going to happen as a result of that? God's words will be known to us. The Bible comes alive. He speaks to our hearts. We have conscience not seared, now restored. This is fantastic. He loves us. And we get not only a garland on our head, but we get knowledge. Why? Because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. That's what it all starts with. So in verse 29, the response could be hating knowledge, not seeking God diligently, not calling on Him, but really, at bottom lines, choosing God's fear. That's a choice of our will. You don't have to feel it. You don't have to spookily, cosmically gyrate and raise it up psychologically. This is something that God says, if you choose His fear, and turn to His reproof, He will pour out His Spirit on us and make His words known to us. It's a guarantee. He doesn't have to say, well, maybe we'll work it out. He makes it as clear as the boys saying, throw your lot in with us. He just says, you're not going to get a whole lot of benefits except me and my words and my Spirit. He doesn't promise you more a thicker wallet. He promises you Himself. That's worth it all. Verse 33, he who listens to me shall live securely and be at ease from the dread of evil. The number one fear out there, the number one worry people have is fear. That is the number one emotion people have about the future. It's not confidence, but fear. And he says, you're going to lie down and sleep sweet. Live securely. You don't have to build a bigger fence. You know, in South Africa, they built taller fences. And you still had to come out of the house sometime. And that's when carjackings took place. You still have to, you know, you can build bigger walls around you. You can get bodyguards around you, like those Hollywood celebrities who come here. You can get a thicker wall of celebrities, but still, you have to experience life. He says, that's not security is not in the walls. Security is in your relationship with God. And then you'll live securely. How? Because we chose God's fear. We turned to His reproof. He poured out His Spirit, and He made His words known to us. That's not just a one-time deal. It's a daily deal. We die daily. We choose to live God's fear daily. We still have opportunities to run quickly to evil or to walk in the right path.